Good morning, Brother John.
Good morning, Jerry.
Wow, oh. We're cooking
now.
Got
a plateful here, don't we? Yeah, we got a lot of stuff.
Oh, my gosh. And you know what? It's important. This is, you know, there's a lot of podcasters, potential podcasters listen to this. So here's the message, all right? If you really want a podcast, you got to have a t-shirt. You got to have your own podcast t-shirt. And, you know, we're so lucky we have one. And it's soft.
So true.
It's beautiful. It works at work, as we talked about last week, right?
Yes.
And it's also essential for actually doing the podcast. That's my prep. That's part of your prep, too, I think, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, you got to be in uniform or you're not ready to play.
Whoa. Well said. So anyway, this week we got some great stuff. One other little show note I'll pitch out there. I worked this weekend a little bit on an app, a bro show app. So that, fingers crossed, we'll get a little something. We'll have it on Windows and Mac first, probably, and then we'll see if we can't get it on iPhone and Android. But this would be like the ultimate way to listen to the bro show.
Yes.
Yeah, I know. All right, buddy. So,
what do we got in store here? Okay, yes. What we're going to do is spend the first two segments, the ones on sports and film, on centering on a movie that came out. That's what kind of precipitated this. Detroit. Decided to take a look at the background a little bit of the movie, and then perhaps look at some of the sports angle to this whole thing.
Yes.
Just to kind of put this in perspective, Detroit, the movie, which came out about a week ago, centers around the 1967 Detroit riots. And there were probably maybe a half a dozen major cities that were hit with riots that summer.
Yep.
And I don't want to confuse them with the 68 riots, which were ones that were precipitated in these riots. The one in Detroit took place in July of 67, while the 68 riots were April.
The one everyone thinks of, right?
Well, and that has to do with Martin Luther King's assassination. And you've got cities such as Washington, Chicago, Baltimore involved in those riots. But I think it's important for us to realize that it all kind of starts with the one in particularly the whole thing with those riots starts with the ones in 67 and the one in Detroit. And I mean, it was very big. In fact, the amount of damage done to property was second only to the L.A. riots in the early 90s.
Oh, yeah.
So you
Why can't we
get
all get along with that one?
Yeah. So what we've got here is here's the baseball connection.
Okay.
The July 23rd is the beginning of the riots, and we'll talk a little bit about how it all started in a bit. But the fact is that Willie Horton is a baseball player that at that time played for the Detroit Tigers, and the Tigers had a doubleheader at home on July 23rd. Willie played in the second game. Willie moved to Detroit at the age of five and actually lived fairly close to the center of the riots. So, you know, everybody said, well, you know, be safe, stay away from the riots, this and that. Well, Willie, for some reason, and
nope.
In his own mind, he couldn't figure out why he did all this, but he didn't even take his uniform off. He went down in the middle of the riots and tried to be a peacemaker, which was mission impossible, but I don't think we should undermine his effort to do so and his desire to try to bring some a semblance of peace to what was going on. So the fact is that as Willie's career moved on, he was always very instrumental in community relations. As it relates to the Tigers, he would work as a player with the communities in order to try to instill baseball into people's lives there as a means of recreation. Once he retired, he was hired by the Tigers to continue in that capacity. And so that he, you know, he's retired now, but, you know, the thing is that he is well known for being a community leader within the city of Detroit. So to give you a sense of his place in Detroit history in terms of the riots and social history, Willie is only one of four people that has a day commemorating his birthday that takes place, I think it's in October. So they have that the state of Detroit, the state of Michigan has a Willie Horton Day every year where they make sure to honor Willie for what he has done, not only for his heroics that took place on that day back on July 23rd, but also the continuation of his efforts to try to maintain some sort of semblance of peace and order as things were trying to get back to a sense of normalcy. I would also like to comment about the fact that the Tigers, when you think about the Tigers, and this is just fortuitous, but the Tigers were a very competitive team in 67 and 68. They were in one of the tightest pennant races in 67. So here we are, July, towards the end of July, we've got the riots. And I'm not saying that baseball is the solution for all problems, but the fact is it did seem to settle things down. People could get their minds off the riots by following a very, very competitive team in 1967. Now, that was followed up by the fact in 1968, they won the American League pennant. And much to my chagrin, they beat the Cardinals in the 1968 World Series.
But you know what? I think that,
three games to one.
I think a city gets a sense of momentum, and I think you're right. I think that what happens is that Willie kind of was the fulcrum point. He moved it, you know. He moved it over. He made something happen, and I think the whole city and the team, they rallied. They got something.
They did.
Yeah,
I think you're absolutely right. And so Willie wasn't what you call a great player. He had 325 home runs, so he's a very, very good player. Spent most of his career at Detroit, did move around a little bit. Outfielder, one of these corner outfielders who wasn't very fast, but could hit for power. And so one great guy, and I think it's important for us to recognize that quite often sports can play maybe not a major part, but does play a minor part in these episodes. And I just wanted to point out Willie's heroics went far beyond the diamond. He was a hero.
And he continued that role.
Yes.
Good man.
So it isn't like he wasn't just a one night guy, you know, going up there and standing in the bed of a truck with his uniform on as just chaos is going all around. You have to understand we've got 1,000 people being injured. We got over 40 people being killed during the 4 or 5 days that this riot took place. So, you know, he's in harm's way as he is trying to make well with respect to all of this.
Yep.
So, kudos to Willie. And I just wanted to do that at the front end. And before we get into the riots themselves and the movie, So the movie
is a hot movie right now.
It's a pretty good, it's a hot movie. Yeah. It's
for good reasons.
Director. Yes. I think what we've got here is the movie deals with, and what I was interested in is because there are several incidents during the riots that are quite often centered on. And what they do is there's a Hotel Algiers where basically eight blacks are in this hotel, and they're confronted by the police who are looking for a sniper that doesn't exist, and the punishment and death that some of these people go through in order to try to figure out what's going on. It's a little squeamish. So that's the middle of the movie. But what I liked about the movie is that it puts it in the context.
Spoiler
of the
alert!
Whole
by the way, we're gonna do some spoilers here, right?
No, I guess I don't. It's
a little bit.
I would say, a little bit.
Okay.
So the thing is that this did not take place at the very beginning of the riots. This took place 2 or 3 days into the riots. What happened was that the riots were precipitated by a by a welcome home party that was given for a couple of Viet vets, black Viet vets, that had come back, and there was an unlicensed nightclub where they were all celebrating. And the police came in and basically herded them all off. And as they herded them all off, it just erupted, because as the people, you know, as the other bystanders saw it going on, it resulted in looting and et cetera. So, which, you know, brings forth, and that all escalated during it. So that's what started it and continued for almost 5 days of looting. You've got injuries, et cetera, as you've got not only the Detroit police involved, you got the National Guard, and
ooh.
Lyndon Johnson brought in the U.S. troops in order to try to get this all sorted out. And so it was a pretty nasty situation. So, so that kind of gives you an idea of what happened. Now, in the background, we've got, the bringing together of these eight people in the Hotel Algiers. Now, the Hotel Algiers is I would say that it's the kind of hotel that you would probably rent out by the hour rather than by day.
Okay.
It had a lot of prostitutes in it. And so the reason that we kind of see this happening, this being a focal point, is that there is a Motown group that gets involved in this whole exercise called the Dramatics. Now, the Dramatics are a Motown group that came out with a hit song later on called What You See Is What You Get. They had a couple other hits. And what happened was, during the riots, they were at the Fox Theater. They were going to come on in one of their very important gigs to get them out there. And they show Martha Reeves and the Vandellas. And as soon as Martha Reeves and Vandellas are done with their part of it, they close the Fox Theater, and everybody's told to go home. And two of the members of the Dramatics end up getting on a bus and trying to head home, but realize that the bus is getting, you know, bombarded with rocks, etc., and it's going to be pretty dicey. So as a result, what they end up doing is they end up getting off the bus and trying to find a place to stay. So they stay at the Hotel Algiers.
Oh my God.
So they get confronted with all this. And so there's eight or nine people. It's kind of mind boggling. I have trouble really putting my arms around. By the way, the background of the Hotel Algiers, it was owned up until about 4 or 5 years before the riots by white owners. It was fairly close to General Motors. And General Motors used, let's just say that they had they kind of found a way to get themselves over there to the Hotel Algiers periodically, some of the people that worked there. So it had been sold. It was black owned. And it had nice – you look at it, it's surreal. I mean, you're in the middle of riots and you watch these people. And what it is, it's all these – there's not a lot of them, but there's probably 20, 30 blacks at a swimming pool setting. And maybe a dozen girls, some of them black, some of them white.
Right.
So what happens is that the ones they end up kind of congregated together, where they're talking to these eight people. And what really precipitates the police coming in is that one of the guys, one of these guys who's a smartass, decides that he's going to demonstrate how things can happen in terms of all this. So he takes out a starter pistol with blanks and shoots it. Mm. And he shoots it at somebody, leaving the impression that person's died. It's all kind of a staged thing, scaring the shit out of the rest of them. Mm. Well, the problem is that the police outside hear that. They rush in, and they end up, these three cops end up coming in, wanting to know who has been firing, at the police, when in effect nobody's been from the Hotel Algiers has been firing at the police. The noise came from a starter pistol.
Oh my God.
So you got a situation that started. Now,
talk about a bad idea.
Yeah. What a mess. And of course you've got three white policemen And we'll talk a little bit about some of the players in all this that can make a difference. So they go through an excruciating line of testimony and browbeating where the police come and try to take some of them in the room and then shoot, but don't kill them, but leave the impression that they've just shot somebody to try to force the other to say it. I mean, everybody, it's just so, it's hard to watch. That's all I can say. So they go through all this, and eventually what happens is that out of all of this, I could only see two people getting killed. One of them was the original starter pistol guy who might have been killed before the police even came in. And one of them was the fact that of the three policemen, one of them was stupid enough not to go along with the way they were doing things. In other words, shooting a gun not at somebody, but just to make believe. And he ended up shooting somebody. So when they realize that they've shot somebody, that's when the police get a little nervous. And it's kind of a mind-boggling thing where the U.S. troops come in and take a look at what's going on. They say, well, this is a Detroit matter. We're walking away from it. So you get the feeling, God, somebody could stop this. Now, the players in this are they're like four or five black guys, and there's two white girls, and there are two members of the Dramatics. So those are the players, and finally, eventually, they're all the police just say, "Get your ass out of here," and they just run away, and so that's how that whole thing ends. Now, that's about there's the beginning where they show of the movie where they show how the whole riot start. There's a be in middle of the movie where they show the Algiers incident. The last third of the movie deals with the fact that what happens to the police, because the police clearly the three policemen have shot at least killed at least one person, if not two. And so these three cops are put on trial many a year or two later, and it's they show that in the movie where it they are basically let go because they are considered to be justified homicide is the way it all comes out because they had a slippery lawyer that was able to get them out of it. They never did practice, did never were policemen again, but they didn't stay walk is what it boils down to. And that's probably the tragedy of it all. The other thing that ends is that the one of the two Dramatics, the lead singer, he just this whole event has been so traumatic to him that he can't go back and sing with the group. He just can't do it. And he ends up going and becoming a member of a choir and finds some solace in the fact that he's
At
singing
a church, yeah.
religion at a church while the remainder of the Dramatics, including the other one that was there at the hotel, end up subsequently in the 70s having a couple hit songs. And they're all part of Motown, the group is the Dramatics. So what you see is what you get. It's probably the one song, if you heard it, you would recognize it. So we've got a director here, Kathryn Bigelow. Kathryn is a is well known. She's done several very important movies. She did Zero Dark 30, and also what's the other one? Locker. What's
The
the
locker room.
locker?
Those are great
Called The
movies.
Locker. Yeah, I mean, these are very, very good movies, and so she's got a great reputation going into it, and I think she feels a need to tell this story and to tell the whole story and to tell it in a way that shows you the injustice. And I think what's sad about it all is that as we take a look what's happening today, we see that injustice is still taking place. All you have to be, I'm in Chicago and I see, a cop shooting a guy in the back 16 times. Running away from them, and that's going to be the first Chicago police officer to be tried for murder. And there's maybe been one or two other than that, so it gives you an idea of how these things don't happen very often.
Right, the trials.
So, Yeah, the trial. So, and you could go to Ferguson,
Yep.
and take a look at that. So, I mean, it's she's just saying, you know what? What happened in 67, we're still seeing it happen now. So I think that that was her bend on doing it and doing this. So, the movie is done. I would call it mostly a drama. It's got a little bit of documentary in it where we see occasionally splice into the movie. Some of the policemen, we see George Romney, the governor of Michigan, make a couple of statements during it. We hear Lyndon, I don't think we see Lyndon Baines Johnson, but
We hear him
President
though.
Johnson, but we hear him. Yeah, we hear him. So that was, so that's where it fits in terms of that. There's also an interesting thing that is done for, and I don't know, some people don't like this and other people don't, but there's a lot of the handheld jittery camera, I
Yeah,
call it.
cinema verite.
Yeah, so some people go for that. It didn't. Let me just say at this point, it's pretty minor.
Okay,
So as
good.
a result of the, you're not going to be distracted that long, if at all, in terms of that use. So I was reading through the reviews, and I would call the reviews mostly very good, but I always like to read the reviews that kind of, don't necessarily give it a good review, to kind of see what other people are
Yeah.
thinking about it.
Yeah.
And a couple things that can be brought up. One is that a lot some people feel that the movie tried to cover too much ground. In other words, the idea of taking it all the way from the riots through to Motel Algiers, then to the trial. When I think that and the other thing is that the benchmark for a movie is 2 hours. This one goes 2 hours and 28 minutes. So
Oh.
so it's a little bit longer than most movies
Did it
now,
go
because
fast
the
though while
gov
you're watching it? Did it go
I
fast?
didn't have any problem with it with respect
Okay.
to that. But I can tell you that as I look back and read some of the things, you could have probably done the trial thing in one of those things where you just do the little captions at the end of the movie, where
Right.
you say what happens
Yeah,
and
yeah.
cut maybe 15 or 20 minutes out of it if you want to. Although I have no problem. The other thing I like to talk about is that there is a, there's a, I take a look at this movie and say, well, where is it going to go in terms of Academy Awards
Right,
or any
right.
awards in general? Now it's you have to understand now this movie's coming out in August, and typically with the Oscar-winning movies come out later in the year,
Right.
so timing isn't everything. But I would say of all the players in the movie, that the lead singer that decides to become a
A
gospel
choir
singer
guy,
or work for
yeah.
choir guy, and kind of I'm going to try to bring him up. He definitely
Outstanding
he
performance.
yeah he could. But I'll tell you, it's here's what's amazing: the one that probably does it has even a better one, and then his name is Algie Smith. That's who plays Larry. He's like the singer, but the one that just sticks out is one of the cops,
Oh.
one of the bigots, a guy named Will Poulter, who's English. He's
Really?
his whole theatrical background, Poulter. So, is yeah, he probably stands out as the one who does his who could potentially get some sort of nomination for it now. I kind of thought politically, God, this doesn't sound real good, does it?
No,
We're gonna, but you know
that doesn't
what?
sound
There's,
right.
but it has precedent.
How so?
Rod Steiger. In the Heat of
Oh,
the Night, was it called?
yes, you're
Sidney
right.
Poitier.
Yes. I
So
forgot
it
about
isn't
that.
like it would be unheard of. Yeah, I kind of decided I would. I thought of the movie and then I thought, did Steiger get an Academy Award for that? And sure shit, he got the Academy Award for the best actor that year. So, it isn't like unheard of that we might that one fellow might play, and boy, he plays a badass. He is awful in the movie. And he does it
Well,
with a, go ahead.
now I was just going to say, but given the current climate, if that happens, the Academy's already under fire for misrepresenting
Yeah.
blacks in awards, and justifiably, plus There's just so many of these shootings, like, you know, you just described earlier, and we had one down here in Texas that was totally, oh, sad. And so, you know, this would be the worst time ever to do something like that, I think, from a not just politically, but humanitarian. Is that the right word?
I think, yeah, I you know what, this might not even be a big deal, because,
yeah.
Because this movie, although it's considered very good, might not be considered for Academy Awards. It's just because of the timing. I think it's got an incredible black cast. The guys in it, there's a guy who plays a Viet vet who's one of the eight guys at the motel who's really good. I mean, you could take a look at all of the black guys that are in the movie in the Motel Algiers, and each one of them does an incredible performance. So, but I'll tell you what's kind of funny, not funny, but really sticks out about this Detroit cop, was that he has a way of making a quick smile in the middle of all this crap.
Oh, geez.
Reminds me of Richard Widmark. It's not more subtle than Richard Widmark's laughing, you know, as he throws the lady down the stairs in a wheelchair.
Right.
This is much more subtle than that, but it's there. Ugh. So it's amazing the things that kind of you take out of the movie and remember. And so that was one. A couple people ragged on the fact that the movie wasn't filmed on location. It was filmed in a lot of it was filmed in Brockton, Massachusetts. They thought, hey, you know what? There's a lot of area. There's a lot of crashed up places in Detroit that you could probably have filmed this. So some people took exception to that, but I think it's not exactly what I call a big point, but I recommend the movie. I think I originally was concerned about the fact that they were only going to tell the Motel Algiers without telling the whole story. I think they do a good job of telling the beginning in terms of riots in general and the Detroit 67 riot specifically. I think they do a good job after the Algiers incident of then showing the policeman going in on trial, and you see all the blacks sitting back in the courtroom going nuts. Mm. When these guys are walking, it's pretty sad. So I think it has a dramatic impact, very good. And so I would recommend seeing it. It's a really good movie.
Well, yeah, one of the points I would make here too is that I think with regard to awards and such, I think some of the award granting bodies are going to do a better job of evaluating this movie than the Academy Awards. Because the problem with the Academy Awards is they're very, they're like, well, they're a body of what? They're the SAG people, right? And so what happens is that's a big group and it spans a huge age range. In general, I kind of lump them together and try and see a person in that group. And that person is older and that person is white. So what occurs to me is things have to be, and this isn't about prejudice. This is about mental acuity. I think sometimes the body is simplistic and they need to be able to categorize something before they can vote on it. And I think they're going to have a little trouble categorizing this because it, like when I first heard about it, and I'm an older white guy, so when I first heard about it, I was like, oh, is this a docudrama or a documentary kind of, right? And so there's that. That might be a problem because, you know, they're not going to think about it properly and frame it and contextualize it properly. So that could be a problem in terms of being recognized. Now the Golden Globes, that's a different thing entirely.
Yeah. That's probably a one that's more, spread out. It's more on the people's feeling about it. This and that. There's a lot of awards that are out there that are more based upon the public than they are the small group of guys who vote on the Academy Awards.
Right.
Yeah, well,
let's see how it goes. Let's see what our predictions look like too.
Yeah, I would only say that as much as you maybe hear about the docudrama part of it, I would never categorize this movie as a docudrama.
Okay.
Never.
Good.
Because it has just way, way, way too little of that documentary in it to be categorized as such. The only other thing is I agree with you in terms of the Academy. The Academy, unfortunately, they think too much sometimes. You know, when they're trying to posture the Academy in the right light, and
they're self-conscious.
They take that into they're very self-conscious and very political. So as a result, they might take a look at it, and who knows? Maybe one of these black guys might. You know, the best thing they could probably do would be, because these other guys, you know, the policemen could take any of these eight guys and put them up for a supporting actor.
Yeah, true.
And that might fit the bill a little better, and give them
there's
a chance to win.
Script, director, best picture. You know, there's a lot of other things too.
I get a feeling that what's her name, Catherine Bigelow could very well get nominated. She's going to be in people are going to be talking about this.
She's got momentum.
She could very well. She has. I agree. So, I don't know what else to say about it. It's a very good movie. I would say that I was kind of concerned about the fact it would be get a little squeamish, but my sense is that it isn't a blood and guts gore type thing. It's more based upon mentally the mental anguish that these people are going through, rather than any graphic scenes of violence.
Okay. Well, that's
good.
And
here's a piece of trivia that I didn't know, and I need to work on. There are a couple of cities that are located within the city limits of Detroit.
Oh.
Amtrak, who I've heard, maybe you remember Amtrak, is one of them. The other one, I think, is Highland Point. No, I only bring up Amtrak because one of our favorite wrestlers is from Amtrak.
Right. That's right.
Who was that?
I can't remember, but you told me last week, and I've already forgotten.
Killer Kowalski.
Oh, Killer Kowalski, of course.
But, you know, it's amazing the things you learn as you start working on this, and I guess the parts of the movie were filmed there. And then all of a sudden you take a look, and I'm reading I read the trivia notes under IMDb, and it says some of the movie was filmed at Hamtramck, Michigan, a city which lies entirely within Detroit.
Oh.
Isn't that crazy?
Well, wait
a
minute.
How could you have a city? Take a look geographically, it's surrounded by Detroit. I don't know how that all works.
I don't either.
Is that
Ferguson? Ferguson, maybe, you know, is that within the city or is that the county? I can't remember.
No, Ferguson is a suburb.
Okay. All right. Of St.
Yeah,
Louis.
Yeah. St. Right. Louis. St. Louis is pathetic in terms of they're landlocked. They'll never be able to increase beyond to make St. Louis County a part of St. Louis City. So it's very sad. Yeah. That's that's another podcast.
Another topic. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that pretty well tells the story about the movie and
well,
I like
glad
I said,
you,
I totally recommend.
Glad you did the legwork on this because you know, I've been kind of captivated by it. I've seen it. It's gotten a lot of play. They had a premiere here the Thursday night before the general release of the movie in Austin, and one of the great venues in Austin we've talked about before is the Alamo Draft House, and they get some of the best events. They have a movie film festival and all kinds of great stuff. But one of the things they did was they had a speaker come in and talk, and it was good. You know, they had a great premiere. They had like special ticket sales to support a group that fights these issues that we've been talking about, the crazy injustice that goes on with the police, and for some reason people who are brown or black, I don't know what this thing is about, but it's a very multi-textured issue. John, one question before we go on to our next thing. I was curious, when you read the reviews, did anybody feel that the movie was unfair to law enforcement?
No. Not that I can see.
Good.
But I did want to comment, since you mentioned the reception or having the movie premiere. I happen to have a friend of mine who went to the Detroit premiere, which was the premiere in Detroit.
Who was it?
It was one of the bartenders at the Ale House, a guy named Skyler. He's from Detroit, and all of a sudden he gets a call and somebody says, hey, I got a ticket for the premiere of this see the premiere of this movie, and he just went home and watched it, and then I've talked to him since then. And there's an interesting thing that came out of it that as we were discussing the premiere, which he said was incredibly good, where Catherine Bigelow, some of the actors and actresses got up there and talked the movie.
Oh, wow.
It was just really well done. But when he got all done, he says, you know what? I felt a little uncomfortable because, you see, probably I would say that out of the 5,000 people, and this was all done at the Fox Theater, which is kind of interesting since a portion of the movie takes place in the Fox Theater because of that Martha Reeves and the Vandello Dramatics. He says, I felt a little uncomfortable because I would say that probably 200 of the people at the at there were white, and, you know, the overwhelming portion of the people were black. And one of the guys I know said, you know what? Should have been just the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like singing to the choir. Yeah. It's like you're singing to the choir, you know, when you have all those people. And I know you want to have, you know, where they can see it and this and that.
Sure.
But there's another side of it that says, yeah, the people who ought to see this ought to be some of these white people.
Yeah. True. Too true.
So, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
So we are moving on to, the fake news. I would say that over this past week, Bill Browder's testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee and some of the ramifications of it, they're very, very hard to sort through.
Yeah, they are.
I think Bill Browder, he's the president of a large investment firm by the name of, I think, Hermitage.
Yeah.
Hermitage is the name of his firm. Hermitage Capital Management. Bill Browder had been working with the Russians in terms of investment for probably starting in the late 90s. And what happened was once Putin got in, he realized that things weren't going to go his way and he was going to get himself in deep trouble if he didn't bail some way.
Right.
So I think that you listen to and I just got done this morning listening to the testimony that he did. We're talking about a man he's originally from Chicago. He's very well learned. He's a very good conversationalist. This man can deliver, you know, the spiel. He's incredibly good. He's fun to he's not fun, but he's not boring by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, he doesn't overuse the language. He answers questions by answering them instead of obfuscating. And it's refreshing. I found the whole thing inspiring just from the standpoint of I saw those senators at their best, which is, I hate to say, it's somewhat rare. And I saw someone giving testimony who didn't exaggerate, didn't go outside of his wheelhouse, stuck to the facts, stuck to what he knew. And what he had to say, for me anyway, was illuminating. Although, as you say, if you tease out the edges of it a little bit, you can quickly get lost because it's a very complex issue. And it's overwhelming.
These oligarchs is a term that's used, which refers to the financial bigwigs in Russia who have incredible political influence. The oligarchs are the ones that, control the wealth. But the problem was when Putin got in, that he wanted to control the wealth. So
right.
What he did is he basically put up one guy and one of the main oligarchs and sentenced him to jail. And then
very publicly.
Enough,
very
Page,
publicly.
Yeah, it was humiliating. And so what happens, the rest of the oligarchs are waiting outside the door the next day. Putin's office say, hey,
what do you want?
What do you want from us?
Yep.
In order to keep us from being the next one in line to get arrested. And he says, very simple. What I want is 50% of your income.
Yep, your wealth.
Yeah, and it wasn't like he doesn't want it for the Russian party. He doesn't want it for the Russian government. He wants it for himself. That's it.
Well, let me make a comment about this. I thought about this a good bit this week. And by the way, everybody, watch this testimony. It's not like 5 minutes. Watch the whole thing because it's very interesting. But what I thought about when I heard that, I thought to myself, well, that's totally corrupt, number one. That's terrible. But if you look at it, if you zoom way back and look at it, you go, well, you know what? He struck a balance, a perfect balance, 50%. he struck a balance. These kleptocrats, which is what they're called, or oligarchs, whatever you want to call them, these guys are not going to control things. And on the other hand, Putin's not going to quite control things either. So they have got a weird, weird kind of balance that they've struck there that keeps the country from being overrun in a way, in a really strange way. So, you know, I kind of had a second and third take on this thing that probably not a lot of people are going to have. But my take on it was, you know, Russia is a different kind of place. It's not like the United States. It's not Kansas anymore. You know, it's just, you just have to face that. And that these people have a problem in that they just can't live without a dictator. You know, you give them somebody reasonable and he gets overthrown. You know, just look at their history. They got to have a czar of some sort. Otherwise, it can't seem to function properly. They just have this thing about chaos and their ability to deal with it and stuff. And I don't want to overgeneralize or smear the Russian people. But, yeah, it's a little crazy. And so that led to this thought I had about a weird kind of thing that Putin did that is somewhat functional. But it's not in everybody's benefit, as we'll find out in a moment.
Jeez, I mean, I kind of sense you're trying to say, well, this is like a check and balance like we would have with three forms of the judicial, the legislature, and the executive branches of our government. All we've got is we've got two here in terms of Russia, but I don't know. All I can say is that you have done an incredible job of putting a positive spin on a rather atrocious situation.
No, it's not positive. This is not positive at all. It's sad.
In other words, you're rational. You're kind of trying to explain atrocious behavior.
How does it happen? That's my question. See, no, everybody goes, how is it that this happened? Oh. That's what people always ask about Russia. And I'm just telling you, that's how it happens. It's not good. I'm not saying it's good. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not trying to justify it. I'm just saying that's how it happens right there, is because they got this thing. And you know, they have a weird way of balancing themselves out. And I don't think this is a one time. I think this goes on over there, you know, decade after decade, generation after generation. My thoughts. Okay.
Well, I think that as we take a look at his testimony, there's an effort to try to connect dots between this and the meeting that Don Jr. and Jarrett had with, believe me, and I'm bad on these doggone names. There was a female Russian attorney who was political.
I can't handle that name either.
And there's a couple other Russians involved.
Yeah, there's Kislyak. He's not there, but he's involved.
Yeah, so the point being that it was kind of interesting because it's like Don Jr., when he first came out and described the meeting, says, well, we talked about Russian adoption. Well, as this pointed out, that's probably a code word in the doggone thing, because you see, Russian adoption, you could connect with the Magnitsky Act. The Magnitsky Act is an act that takes place because what they try to do is they're trying to basically categorize certain bad guys in Russia and say, these guys are going to be put on a hit list. A list of guys who are not going to be allowed to conduct business in the United States. And in order to keep them from doing that, what we'll do is we'll basically not allow them to have bank
we'll
accounts
account.
With U.S. banks.
We'll seize
their accounts, seize their assets, do that. And that kind of, I guess, got Putin excited, too. He didn't
like
that.
Well, I guess so. $250 billion. He got real excited, and he's still real excited about this.
Yeah.
That's a euphemism.
So, So that's all part of it. Magnitsky or whatever, this act, though, is named after a attorney that Browder hires at a certain point in his work with Russia, because what he was doing is he's an investment company that would invest money for Russian companies. And, well, which is another word for if you kind of look, it's sort of like wandering.
Yeah.
And that's a whole nother thing we can talk about. The fact is, this guy's so, but the point being that, you know, you've got this, you know, this is the work he was doing. And all of a sudden, the light bulb goes off. And he says, "Ooh, things are not so good here. We could get ourselves in trouble, this and that. So I'm going to hire this brilliant Russian attorney to go and investigate." He investigates and finds out all these ridiculous things that are going on that we've kind of talked about already. Putin and his involvement, etc. And Magnitsky, rather than Russia says, "Well, why don't you testify?" Well, rather than when he gets ready to testify, rather than testify, he ends up in jail. He ends up being because, as Browder says, when it comes to Russia, there are no good guys; they're all bad guys.
Yeah, that's what he says. Well, of these people we're talking about, we're not talking about the general population. We're talking about the thousand oligarchs.
No, we're talking about the oligarchs and
Putin and his minions.
So here's another interesting thing that came out of it. Magnitsky Act, which we described, you know, is to try to keep freeze assets, do this and that, is a law that has been passed by the House of Representatives and the Senate.
Yes.
So you have this meeting with Don Jr., et cetera, and all these guys, and the Magnitsky Act is part of the discussion. Well,
yep. That's what adoption is about. That's what adoption's code for, right?
But if the Senate and the House are the ones who pass the law, how is it going to do any good to talk about, you know, getting doing something in terms of the of this act? Because it sounds to me like you'd have to get it repealed. No, you don't have to get it repealed. Guess what? The executive branch, the prez, has the authority to pull people off of the list.
Yes.
Oh, God, I couldn't believe
that.
The
OFAC, I think it's called the OFAC. It's an act an order or something. He can use that to pull people off the list. You're right.
So, here we are. We're talking about the pieces of this puzzle that we can almost understand. I mean, it's difficult.
Keyword, almost.
Almost, yeah.
What makes it so hard to understand? And you enunciated this a couple days ago, John, I think. You know, what's the deal here? Why can't we understand it? From my standpoint, I stumble around with laundering money. I still have difficulty understanding exactly what laundering money is. And I think if you poll people in the United States, most of them can't really describe in detail what it is and how it works. But that's out there for me. And I know you got some other issues with all this too, from a CPA point of view.
Yeah. Well, when I think of laundering money, I think of something very personal. Mm. And for example, let's say that I wanted to put $500 into the account of my brother, like you.
Oh,
I could cut a check and I issue a check and make the deposit.
Right.
But what I can't do, I can't do cash.
Right. Yes. Well, not over a certain amount. Isn't it 5,000 now? Or 10,000?
I don't know. I got a feeling that what's happening is I think the banks are, each of them have their individual thing. Uh-huh. And I know that Chase, they didn't talk about an amount. I saw the little notice up there and I thought, what that?
Any cash, I get
that. Yeah, any cash.
Wow.
So, oh boy.
I bank at Wells Fargo, so we all know what the deal is there.
Oh, shit.
Worst bank in the world. Well, except for the Russian bank. Wow.
Yeah, I think of Bank of America and Wells Fargo, then Bank of America. Two very pathetic financial institutions. Sure. I used to talk about the fact that when I was Bank of America bought out a bank here called LaSalle Bank. LaSalle Bank was an incredible client-friendly bank. Here's what was so amazing about it, was that when you were trying to escape Bank of America and put your money in another account, I made a mistake. What I did was I got all the money out. But if you read the fine print, if they get a wire transfer in that is for a bank account that's closed within 90 days, they will reopen the bank account. They will put the money in. They will call you, and then you have to pay to get it out.
Oh, nice.
That's Bank of America.
No, nice.
You know what? That's just normal BS. I can handle that. You know, that's the reason we can't understand Russia, because it's beyond our comprehension. So here's where I'm coming from a, like you alluded to, the from the accountant's perspective, and that is, where is, let's follow the money. Out of all of this, there is only one amount of money that is mentioned several times in this whole testimony, specifically $230 million. Now, here's the way the $230 million plays into it. Apparently, Hermitage, that's Browder's company, pays taxes and has paid $230 million to Russia.
Right.
So what happened was that Russia went in, and Putin and his oligarchs or whatever went in and confiscated all of some of the seals and corporate identity information. And what they were able to do is something which we see happen here in the U.S., and that is they were able to apply for a refund and get it. So, you know, we see that happen all the time as fraud. Well, so what happened was that they were able to get that $230 million. Putin was able to get it.
Yeah, he got it refunded to himself.
Yeah, exactly. So my feeling was, if a person is paying $230 million, Browder's paying $230
in tax,
what is he doing? If that's his taxes, he's probably done $1 billion worth of service.
Right.
What did he do for that service?
Uh-huh.
They don't talk about that in Russia. And I understand right now he's on a crusade because of this, of the injustices that are done, because Magnitsky not only was put into jail, but he went through an enormous amount of torture, this and that, and eventually died in jail. And he's on a one-man crusade in order to get him. So he's sort of leaving the impression of being a white knight. But I'm a professional skeptic. I'm an auditor. I audited for Pricewaterhouse for 8 years. I always keep a sense of professional skepticism to what I see. And I would like to know, and it was never asked by these senators, how did you make your money? How come you had to pay $230 million in taxes? What did you do? What services were you rendering? And so I to be truthful, as appealing and as wonderful as he sounds, as he leads the charge to, you know, for the Magnitsky Act and this and that, Browder to me is kind of somewhat of a gray guy. I want to see a little bit more how this unfolds.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah. That's just one man's opinion, and I know that nobody else is going to say anything like that. And well, if you listen to the senators who are testimony, they're just fawning over this guy, saying how wonderful it is that you came and you spent an extra day with us. You are so wonderful.
Yeah, I know. It gets a little thick.
Well,
and, you know, after a while, you just kind of go, oh, geez, you know, did he use this dead friend card to, like, distract?
Yeah. Exactly. That's the thing. I'm thinking he's getting on his white, you know, his white horse here, leading the charge for a cause because of his lawyer, which he's got to feel some remorse for throwing into the dungeon.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure. I'm not convinced, and it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds.
Well, the other thing too about this is that, you know, you kind of went around the edges of this, but I'm just going to center on it for a second. One of the other reasons that we can't understand this is that it's corruption at such a high level in government and for such vast amounts of money that we can't shake our heads and go, this is really happening. We kind of have a disbelief thing built in where our mind won't let us accept it or comprehend it because it's staggering. The numbers are staggering.
The decimal point is at the wrong place for us to understand.
Yeah, agreed.
I agree with that. It's and so I think one of the better things out of all this is that it although they're not able to connect specifically the dots to the Trump Jr.'s
Don Jr.
meeting, Don Jr.'s meeting, there clearly is, and I thought this right away when I saw they were talking adoption. I said, man, this is, this, you know, it's sort of like the word adoption was maybe mentioned. So Don Jr. says, yeah, we talked about adoption.
Wrong word now, because the cat's out of the bag.
Yeah, well, adoption, it sort of reminds me of lying through omission.
Well, yes.
In other words, what you do is you tell the truth about 1% of it, and then 99% of it you don't talk about, so therefore it's lying through omission.
It's kind of like John Lovitz. It's like John Lovitz in Saturday Night Live, you know. And I heard Trump do this, where he's being interviewed, and he goes, yeah, well, you know, they didn't talk about anything of consequence. And then he goes, well, in fact, they talked about adoption. Yeah, they talked about adoption. I just saw John Lovitz for a second go, yeah, they talked about adoption. Right? You remember that Saturday Night Live, how we do that? When he's obviously lying, covering and all that stuff.
That's what we thought. That's what they talked about. Yeah.
That's the ticket. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Sad chapter.
The problem here is we're going as this is grinding at a rather slow pace as we go through all this. And
it is, and it is. In the Senate and the House, it is. You're absolutely, the House especially, they're
yeah, Mueller, and how he plays into it. And
Mueller
with grand
is
juries
a different story. Different story.
He's getting grand juries, so maybe things will move a little faster with him.
You know what he's doing, I think, just to do a little side note here on our buddy Mueller, is that I think the guy is pretty cagey. I think what he's doing is I don't know if it's been leaked or what, but this stuff about the grand juries, that is like, that opened the door this last week to people going, ooh, this is getting serious. This guy's using all the tools that he needs to find the information he needs. And not only has one grand jury, he's got three of them, and he's got them in different places, in different jurisdictions. So he's doing it very cleverly. He's doing what should be done. I mean, that is the way these guys do this stuff. But he's signaling to the White House, I think, a little bit here. And those guys are lawyering up even more than they were before. And it's a lot of people are who weren't saying anything before are going, yeah, there's somebody's days are numbered. Someone's going to take the hit. Someone's going to take a fall.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it's this is just a piece of this thing with Browder is just kind of a interesting piece of puzzle. It does offer us an insight that you have to look at, and you have to have a little patience to look through, and you have to understand you're not going to understand all of it, but you got to, you know, got to hang your head on what you can and kind of figure it out. And that's what
absolutely
we're able to do.
Okay. Well,
so,
wow.
All good.
Well, yeah.
Covered a lot
good.
Of ground here.
Well, we did. And that was a pretty deep dive into, as well as we could, into Browder, which is now completely wiped off the map news-wise because of all these other crazy things going on.
Right. But, I mean, Browder, if I never see Browder again, it's quite possible we're not going to hear about him. For that brief moment or the couple of days here in the middle of the week where he was doing testimony, it was kind of interesting to get into.
I thought it was. I thought it was. And, you know, the other thing is, it's background. I mean, let's call it what it is. That's background. He could not testify directly to the things they were actually investigating. But I think he gave them, all the senators and the public, great insight into what's going on and how the Russian machine works, a little bit more anyway. I mean, I don't think anyone could do it. And he himself said, you know, this is like days of testimony if you really want the details. So I think Mueller is going to get a hold of him, and he won't supply anything that's going to be used directly, but I think indirectly, it's
background information. Sorts.
Yeah, if Mueller doesn't already know some of this stuff, he will after he talks to Browder, I believe. So there's that.
Okay. Yep. Right.
It's an hour, buddy. We hit the hour mark.
Yeah, we basically hit it. We're right here approaching 60 minutes, and we're able to do a lot of good stuff. That's all I can say.
I think so, too. And, you know, let's just say it. You guys out there, you need a T-shirt. And that T-shirt URL, the URL. You can use our general URL, which is thebro.show. And that's right. It's not .com. It's .show. That's a legitimate domain. So thebro.show, you can go there and see all our podcasts. And there's links on every show episode. You'll see a link, you know, buy a T-shirt. But if you're impatient, and I understand this, some people are, Some people don't even want to hear the more podcasts. They just have to have a t-shirt. And I understand that. I'm that way. So here it is. It's shirt.thebro.show. We got a little subdomain there, so you can just go right to the t-shirt. Okay.
Very good. Outstanding.
All right, sir.
Okay, well, listen, you have a good day, and I'll be talking to you tomorrow.
All right, John.